Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton from Salon.com, or you may know her as Digby from the Uber blog Hullabaloo. And then author and documentary filmmaker Greg Mitchell on his newest film, The First Attack Ads, Hollywood versus Upton Sinclair, out on PBS and streaming now. Also on the program today, Joe Biden pardons thousands of marijuana possessors and begins the process of recategorizing cannabis legal status. U.S. adds 263,000 jobs in September, despite the Fed's attempt to tank the economy. Meanwhile, Biden says high risk for nuclear Armageddon as Russia's losses mounts. DOJ believes Trump still has some stolen documents. And a Bush-appointed federal judge blocks New York's new gun law. Ex-Oath Keeper witness says Oath Keeper head was in contact with a Secret Service agent. Judge rules Louis DeJoy's changes hurt postal delivery in the run-up to the 2020 election. Once again, begging the question, why is he not fired yet? And authoritarian watch, U.S. to begin screening travelers from Uganda for Ebola. Ebola wants to be free, folks. Meanwhile, new data shows COVID death rates higher amongst Republicans than Democrats. Surprise, surprise. This as the CDC ends daily reporting of COVID cases. Find your own information, folks, but we're not going to provide it for you. Senate races, House will be resolved in 32 days. And Elon Musk, R-O-F-L-M-O-A.
O-A? A-O.
Oh, yeah. All right. Whatever.
Laughing my off ass?
Yeah. Up my off ass. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It's Casual Friday. If you're watching us, you can see that I'm wearing my soft collared shirt. If you're listening to us, you can see that I still have my old man voice because I'm still sick.
My cough is lingering.
It is. I want to make it clear. Multiple COVID tests. Myla had the same thing. She got a PCR test and a strep test. Doctor said there's something going around. I haven't had a cold like this. COVID was worse. But I don't remember a cold like this. I don't know. I don't think I missed, you know. I would have probably had to have missed Wednesday if it wasn't Yom Kippur anyways.
Oh, so Tuesday was rough too?
Tuesday I was in,
yeah,
but Monday I missed because of it, and Tuesday was rough. Wednesday was rough, and Thursday was rough. I mean, I was sleeping all the time. Longtime listeners of the show will know, like, I don't think there was ever a 2 days in a row where I was ever out with a cold.
Yeah.
Ever.
Well, now colds are coming back.
Yeah. Fun.
Right.
And I got my coffee from the coffee guy. Muhammad's cousin Sam. I was running the coffee cart, and I said, he said, I thought you left me because I hadn't been in a couple of days. And I said, no, I've been out. I was sick. And he goes, oh, yeah, I was really sick last week, too. And I'm like, wait, dude, maybe I got it from you.
Same thing. Yeah.
So, all right, let's get into this. Again, you know, when Joe Biden was running in the general election, sense around here was this guy is a cipher. He is going to move to where he perceives the center of the Democratic Party is. And by that, it's not the center of where the voters are. It is also the center of where the elected officials are, as reflected in what the voters are voting for.
Although we should say he was the only major Democratic candidate of, like, maybe the top seven that was not advocating for decriminalizing marijuana on his website.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and I think that we're starting to see that, like, he is, like, tentatively moving into that center position, which is, but I mean, really, it is decriminalization at the very least on a federal level, as opposed to a legal structure for it. But decriminalization on a federal level, on some to some degree, is all you need because the states are, we now at 20 states that have not just decriminalized it, but legalized it in some fashion or another, and everything is moving that direction. However, it's still very hard for you to do banking in states if you're running a dispensary. You can't ship it across country legally. You could theoretically be busted for marijuana possession federally. There are no people in jail right now in a federal level for possession only. However, if you've been convicted of possession on a federal level, and also remember, Washington, D.C., all of those people who have been convicted there are convicted under federal charges. If you've been convicted of it, it's on your record. It's going to hurt you with housing. Mm-hmm. It's going to hurt you with jobs. It's going to hurt you with a whole myriad of things. And to have that now expunged in a pardon is a big deal. But it also, if you're not going to if you're going to pardon everybody for federal possession of marijuana under federal laws of possession of marijuana, it only makes sense that you're going to get rid of the law essentially that would have put people in there in the first place. And that takes a bit of process, but they initiated that as well. Here is Saul, incidentally, and I don't know why I bring this up now, was telling me yesterday that he saw Karen out on the street the other day and was laughing at them. I don't know why it makes me think of that when I
two independent thoughts.
Yes. John Berman, Al Stewart on CNN with S.E. Cup as well. Here are the CNN folks talking about Biden's move.
I think this will be very impactful for Joe Biden and Democrats in terms of winning over a large portion of the voter electorate that thinks this is an important issue. There are a lot of Democrats, and three-fourths of Americans think that we should legalize marijuana. So that is something, certainly a factor in him making...
Pause it for 1 second. I mean, it's interesting how she's raising this, because the last I checked, three-fourths of America are not Democrats.
No.
But they're going to introduce it as a partisan issue. I mean, you should keep... pay attention to this when you ingest your media. Because this is the conflation of Democrats and sort of just like, what is the average position? Or this is done in so many different places now as a way of trying to leverage the polarization that exists.
Yeah.
Three quarters of the American public think that pot should be legal.
And Alice Stewart is saying, you know, that yeah, he'll win over some people, but she has no seemingly self-reflection. Like, am I the one who's out of touch if 3/4 of Americans think this? Like, Biden is not, yes, he's a cipher, but to say he's at the center of this issue is actually incorrect.
No, he is,
on the polling.
Is slowly moving, walking towards the center
moving
of this
towards
issue.
Like the great majority point politically, maybe centrist, but yeah, I mean, the idea that she has no like self-reflection about it's the Simpsons clip. Am I out of touch? No, it's the kids who are.
Right.
Or in this case, it's the Democrats who are also apparently 3/4 of the country.
People could look up like what percentage of people in this country believe in evolution. And I actually think it's less. Only 30% of Republicans believe in evolution. Only 60% of Democrats and 60% of independents believe in evolution. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
So when you say like, well, it's going to help with some of these crazies who believe it should be legalized. Yeah. 3/4 of the country.
We should pause to think about what that says about a political system that is just going for decades and decades against the will of that amount of people.
Without a doubt. And what it says about like, you know, CNN, like how many other, like how many other 25%ers are you going to put on TV and give this poll, this, but continue.
I think this will be very impactful for Joe Biden and Democrats in terms of winning over a large portion of the voter electorate that thinks this is an important issue. There are a lot of Democrats, and 3/4 of Americans think that we should legalize marijuana. So that is something, certainly a factor in him making this decision. I see this as ploy to, and midterms to gain support and gain voters. I happen to think that marijuana is a gateway drug. I'm not a big advocate for legalizing marijuana, maybe for medicinal purposes, but not as a whole.
Why are you looking at me?
No, I'm saying as a whole. But here's the thing. Part of his announcement was to also advocate to governors do the same at the
right.
state level. That's not happening. I reached out to Governor Asa Hutchinson's office in Arkansas. They don't like this. He sees this as
no.
waving the
I reached out to Arkansas. I reached out to Arkansas. I tried. I found the one of the most conservative states I could find, and they seem to be against it.
Yeah.
What a panel to talk about this too. SE Cup and Republican strategist.
This is
Alice Stewart. Almost said Alice Cooper.
This is so demented.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, less people believe in evolution. And she's talking as if this is some type of, she's saying it's a stunt to do what 75% of the country wants. It's a stunt. And what's also even more crazy, she thinks it has medicinal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks it actually, so not only is 75% of the country, more than people who believe in evolution, are in favor of the of legalization, she also thinks it has like, material benefit to people.
They have to concede that point at this point. It's the same way they've like evolved on climate change. It's not happening. It is happening, but it's not man-made. Okay, it's happening, but what do you want to do about it? Like, it's become so overwhelming that they have to kind of give a bit of a quarter measure or whatever. And I mean, it's a window into how Republicans view the broader population, which is like giving the American public what they want and what they feel they deserve and what is just is a political stunt. We are a minoritarian party, and we impose our religious theocracy on people against their will, and most people support abortion rights, but we don't care. We rule and flex our muscles regardless. It's actually kind of lowly to give the people what they want. So even if 75% of Americans are in favor of this, that's what the stunt is, not when we are trying to appeal to our evangelical base by stripping women of their basic rights.
This is what they say when they say hard decisions. The hard decision is, it's very difficult for me to impose this type of austerity, this type of restriction, this type of constraints, this type of morality, mine, on other people. That's a hard decision. We need to be able to make those hard decisions.
I just want to know what happened to the free market, but that's just me.
Oh. Yeah, they have deep
it's
contempt.
It's alive in Arkansas. Go ahead.
No, I think that was it, right?
Oh, was that it? Well, there's 10 more seconds. Sure, let her finish her point.
Yeah.
Do the same at the right. state level. That's not happening. I reached out to Governor Asa Hutchinson's office in Arkansas. They don't like this. He sees this as waving the red flag of surrender to protecting the lives of those who are victims of drug abuse.
All right, first off, It's not a red flag of surrender. It's a white flag. But
you're gonna F up your surrender if you wave a red flag.
Can you pull up the statistics of people who have overdosed on marijuana, please? I'm really curious about that. Because we have legal opiates in this country, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, billionaires from overdoses. And fentanyl, incidentally, you can get it as a prescription. The idea that somehow we go from a legalized pot is a gateway to illicit drugs, or to drugs you can only get as a prescription, is just absurd. There's just no evidence for this. None.
Yeah, you can overdose on, like, Advil. Like, NyQuil is more dangerous than marijuana. It's just absurd.
But also, like, anybody who knows pot smokers know that they're pot smokers. They're not like, exactly. Oh, where's the fentanyl now?
Yes.
Exactly. Got a couple of sponsors, and we'll be right back with Digby in a moment. One of our sponsors is ZBiotics, and they're giving you 10% off with the code Midority. We've talked about ZBiotics. For instance, okay, we got Halloween parties in 3 weeks. I'm going to go to one this year.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to dress up that much. But you here's the bottom line. They're probably going to be on Sunday night. Halloween is on a Monday. This is a big dilemma because, of course, you want to have a couple of drinks, but you don't want to feel like crap the next day because you're probably going to have to go to work. Here's what you do. You drink a bottle of ZBiotics before your first drink of alcohol. One bottle is all you need for the night. Doesn't matter whether you're having one drink or multiple drinks. You drink responsibly. You pace yourself. Get a decent night's sleep. And then the next day, it's like a normal day. You feel good. You're ready to make the most of it. Here's how it works. And this I did not know because I thought that it was like it was because you get dehydrated. And certainly that doesn't help. But it is not dehydration that causes you to feel bad the day after drinking. It is a toxic byproduct of alcohol, which builds up in your unprepared gut. ZBiotics produces an enzyme, sort of like the one that your liver uses, which breaks down this byproduct. ZBiotics is the first, the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It is created by altering the DNA of a natural probiotic bacteria that we eat all the time. ZBiotics is not vitamins. It is not plant extracts, no off-the-shelf ingredients. ZBiotics has been rigorously tested and is FDA compliant for safety. If you're the kind of person that enjoys drinks with friends or wants to unwind at the end of the day and still have a full day planned the next day, maybe you're going to work out, maybe you're going to go to work, maybe you're going to do both, maybe you got your kids, ZBiotic is perfect for you. This is, you know, I've mentioned this in the past. I like to go, maybe hang out with my buddy, have a drink of bourbon or something to that effect. But I found, particularly as I get older, it's hard to do the next day. One thing of ZBiotics, doesn't matter really whether I have one or two, rarely three, but on occasion, next morning I feel fine. No more wasted days.
I could have used this at that wedding I was at the other weekend, where I had like a multiple day hangover.
You can get 15% off. Did I say 10% up top? It's 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic. You go to zbiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority. That's the letter Z, then the word biotics, biotics.com/majority. Coupon code majority at checkout saves you 15%. Link is in the podcast in the YouTube description. Check it out. We've all used this product and it works. They figured it out. Also, another product that I use on a regular basis, had a melatonin gummy last night, actually. Sunset Lake CBD. SunsetLakeCBD.com. If you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. They have tinctures in all sorts of strengths. Two different flavors, actually, mint and citrus. They have gummies. They have gummies with THC as well as CBD. Just enough that is legal that you can send. Apparently, there's a certain amount in a hemp plant, and I don't want to get into it, but they're great. And they have the regular gummies. They have CBD fudge. They have CBD coffee. They have keef and smokables and pre-rolls. Check it out. Great stuff. Third party analyzed. You'll get a sheet of paper that will explain to you everything that's in what you're ingesting for every single product that they have. They practice integrated pest management. That means no pesticides on this stuff. They have great business practices. $20 minimum wage. Most of the company is employee owned. They are movement partners. They have donated tens of thousands of dollars to things like food pantries and strike funds and refugee resettlement and Innocence Project and Give Directly. Great company, great product. Do yourself a favor. Good for sleeping, good for chilling, good for relaxing after a meal if you want to do a smokable, good for mixing with your other smokables, now legal in New York State. Check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com, 20% off with the coupon code LEFTISBEST. All right, let's bring we got to take a quick break. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half. So check it out. Let's bring...
take a quick break and then bring Dick.
Exactly. Thank you. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce our next guest. But first, I've got to play this little ditty on my ditty machine.
Dig the machine.
We are back. Heather Parton, Digby, folks can check out your writing at salon.com and at Hullabaloo. Great to see you as always.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Good to be here.
So you had a piece about the sort of disappearance of Obamacare as an electoral issue, and it'll be a good opportunity for us to discuss the election that's going to take place in about 31 days from today. But before we get there, since we're doing a little bit of throwback Friday, Joe Biden was at a fundraiser, I think it was last night, and And he, there's no footage of this, but he used the opportunity to warn people that we are closest to nuclear Armageddon than we have been at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I interpreted this as his wanting to essentially signal to Putin that we're taking this seriously. We want you to know that we're taking it seriously. We're not operating as if we think this is a bluff, but we're also not going to change our behavior. That's the way that I interpret that. Like the he's going out there and he's not saying this to prepare the U.S. He's saying this to say to Putin, we get it. We get that you're serious, but you should know that we're not underestimating your seriousness, but we're still not going to stop pouring money into this war because you're losing. I mean, what's your sense of what's going on here?
I had exactly the same reaction as you when I heard it last night. Because first of all, look at the where he said it. He didn't go out and say this in some kind of public forum. It was said, I think, in front of, at a fundraiser or some kind of a sort of a private meeting of some sort, knowing that it was going to get out. I mean, that, you know, obviously that it was planted to get out. So, which says to me, I mean, it's kind of a version in a way of the Cuban Missile Crisis gambit that Kennedy did, right? I mean, because he sent a private, he sent, you know, two different messages, one saying we'll pull the missiles out of Turkey and another one saying that they wouldn't and publicly sort of, you know, being very aggressive. The idea being that you're operating on several channels when you're in a situation like this and that you're, you know, you're saying certain things to sort of give an impression. Same thing's happening with Taiwan and China, by the way, where this, what they call strategic ambiguity by having, you know, Pelosi go over there and then, you know, oh, it's no big deal on one hand. And then, you know, so they're trying to sort of keep different channels, you know, saying different things and hoping that this sort of gives at least the people in charge, in this case, Putin, the message that exactly what you just said. So, you know, I think they seem to be handling this pretty deftly. As far as I can tell, I mean, obviously being no expert and we don't know a lot, we probably won't know for many years what was really happening in this whole situation. But, you know, it's very difficult. I did read, you know, and it's scary because, you know, nuclear war actually is on the table. I mean, we're hearing people talking about it very seriously. This is not some, you know, you can't just say, it's just a bunch of saber rattling, because there's an actual war going on and there's some very serious ramifications. And there's a lot of political, you know, churning around this in the U.S., in Europe, and obviously in Russia, which is also maybe the most interesting thing about all this. The fact that Putin did this big, you know, call up of draftees, and there's this huge protest going on within Russia. I mean, people are taking boats across the Bering Strait to get to Alaska now. You know, I mean, that actually happened over the weekend. You know, this is a big deal, and I think that's exactly what they were doing. I mean, you know, I don't know how you know, people like to attribute to Joe Biden that everything he says is a gaffe, and he does commit a tremendous number of gaffes. But in this case, I agree with you. I think this was probably very, very, you know, planned as a way to sort of send this message in a sort of covert, you know, way.
My concern, though, is just that I know that, like, I'm glad we're leading with this, because I feel like the idea of nuclear Armageddon is such, we have a cognitive dissonance about it, because we can't imagine that that would happen. But, I mean, since March or something, Russian forces have held control of Europe's largest nuclear facility. I can't pronounce it, but it's within Ukraine. And now Putin is making like a public declaration to publicly annex it, essentially, and say this is a part of Russia. We're nationalizing this. And so, I mean, that's gotta play into this, because he's trying to be as explicit as he can be. This is on the table, and Biden's now making it clear as well. We're not going to back down, but should we back down a little bit because of I just don't want Ukraine to become a proxy war where both sides are openly discussing nuclear Armageddon. And not saying that Biden's advocating for it, but that the fact that's even in the discussion is concerning.
Oh, it's very concerning that it's in the discussion. Although I don't think that the U.S. is the one that brought this up. I mean, I think this was it's been Putin hinting about this actually from the very beginning. It's interesting. I read an article by Timothy Snyder. You know, the fellow who writes about democracy. I think he's a professor at one of the Princeton, Harvard, somewhere. And he's an expert on the 1930s and you know what happened in Germany, et cetera. And he addresses this issue in his article about the fact that, I mean, first of all, just when you start talking about nuclear war, it's the ultimate nightmare, right? I mean, there's nothing more, especially, I mean, people my age, probably even more than you guys, who grew up with nuclear war being a very, very real possibility. I mean, I went through the drills in elementary school. I was actually part of that, and we believe my father worked for a while in a nuclear test silo in Kansas. So this was just part of our lives, and you know, I still have nightmares about it. I mean, it's just something that's part of, you know, it's part of your psyche when you grow up in that situation. So I get that, and the there is a feeling, and Snyder talks about this in his piece, but also suggests that, you know, basically it is far more likely, and I found this his viewpoint very, you know, comforting in a way. And he was very persuasive, I think. He's a very persuasive writer generally. And he talks about the fact that this is very unlikely to result in nuclear war. Now, nuclear accident, Emma, which you bring up with these nuclear power plants, is kind of a different thing. It's a different form of leverage than saying we might drop a bomb or use tactical nuclear weapons, which is what they've been talking about. And probably even worse, right? I mean, the idea of a nuclear meltdown of that gigantic nuclear power plant, that could be way, way, way worse than Chernobyl. I mean, really, really bad in Fukushima or any of the accidents that we've had. But he points out that Snyder points out that, you know, it's highly unlikely. And what is most likely, if you look at everything that's happened in the post-war world, the nuclear age, is that there's a power struggle going on within Russia, and that is where the real focus is, and that's where the real diplomacy is aimed, and that's where all the, you know, the sort of public discussion is sort of looking at, that all the evidence out there suggests that that is what is really happening. Now, whether or not, you know, that means that, you know, Vladimir Putin feels under threat, or whether, and, you know, will make some kind of impulsive, irrational decision, is unknown, but in his view, it's unlikely. I suggest everybody read that. It's actually quite good. And I don't have an answer. I mean, obviously nobody does. We don't know what's going on here. Your question about whether or not we should withdraw. I just instinctively have a feeling, just looking at history and looking at these kind of situations, that it's probably a bad idea to do that. When you see the rise of the right throughout the globe, right happening right now and within our own country, I just instinctively feel that probably doing that in the face of threats is probably a bad idea. But that's just my opinion, you know. I mean, what do I know?
This is the thing. If you start to walk through, and we should say, you know, we just got an NIM to this effect that Zelensky, I don't know if anybody saw this, the video of Zelensky calling for NATO to do preemptive strikes. The IMer makes the point that it's unlikely that he made that public call without getting a sign off from, you know, the US or NATO or something to that effect, which I think is probably the case. Like, but this would be part of trying to essentially signal to Putin that the U.S. and NATO and Ukraine is taking it seriously, that he is, you know, his threat seriously, but our response is not a function of thinking he's bluffing. Our response is a response to thinking he's serious, in which case it's basically, you know, everybody's testing each other's resolve here, it seems like. And in the event that we were to stop all of our funding unconditionally, it seems to me that what would happen is the war would grind on, but ultimately it's likely that Russia would win. But what is fascinating to me, and this is what I thought from get-go, there was a great piece in The Intercept where apparently the CIA completely got this wrong. I mean, there's a lot of things to be – this is a worthwhile piece to read because, A, it shows the CIA doesn't seem to operate very well anymore. I mean, I don't know if at any time that we had intelligence capability, but like if the CIA can't make this assessment, I just don't know what they can do.
I mean, historically, it's been bad on Russia, I think.
Yes. I mean, very bad, but also bad on like on Iraq. And like and I don't know, honestly, if the CIA ever functioned as an intelligence agency. I'm not talking about the sort of like covert ops. I'm talking about just sheer intelligence. But apparently the CIA thought, and I think as everybody did, and it's probably why everybody did, that Russia was easily capable of coming in and within 3 or 4 days taking Kyiv and presumably killing or exiling Zelensky and taking over the country. And I think you could see at the beginning of the war, before the invasion, you had Joe Biden and the Biden administration running around like the pants on fire, trying to convince people that it was true. Ukraine didn't think it was real. And apparently the CIA was like, it's going to take 3 or 4 days, which is why we didn't see the pouring of money in the way, like, you know, there was money, certainly some money that was brought in weapons given to Ukraine in the months and the years leading up to this invasion. But it's a fraction of what has taken place over the past 10 months. I mean, like a tiny fraction. They weren't going to put money into Ukraine because they thought this is a losing battle. In fact, they pulled CIA operatives and special ops out of Ukraine because they thought, we're going to lose these ops because Russia's going to sort of just steamroll. And I think Putin also thought that was the case. And nobody realized like how decrepit this massive fighting machine had become and how inept the whole thing has become. And then, of course, the United States is like, oh, and NATO, like, Ukraine could win this. We're going to pour this money in.
And more operations within Ukraine than they had previously, according to The Intercept. So, like, which the fact that they're telegraphing it somewhat defeats the purpose, but whatever.
Well, no, I mean, I think at this point, like, I have a problem with us expending this amount of money on war. But the American public, the reality is, the American public does not care an iota. They didn't care that we were doing this when we were the ones who were invading. I mean, you remember this, Heather, like for 2 years almost, upon the launch of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, you could walk around and like nobody seemed to even know that we were at war. And we had 100-some-odd thousand, I mean, more, almost 200,000, maybe at 1.3, you know, more than that, troops on the ground. And now it's just like every now and then there's a number, 760 million, 800 million, 400 million, almost every week there's another number like that. And it's just it is a complete abstraction to the American public. There's no way the U.S. government is not going to pursue this. And, you know, I have a problem with us engaging in war and doing so unconditionally. I would like there to be some pressure exerted to find a negotiated peace. But that also you know, is contingent upon this guy who decided to invade Ukraine and is now, like, his entire regime seems to be in the balance, you know, based upon what he can justify this whole thing from. Like, and, you know, we saw this the last time with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. It basically went down with the ship in Afghanistan. And there's no reason to believe that Putin's not going to do the same thing.
Well, I think that, you know, really, I mean, and it makes logical sense that underlying all of this, and I think, again, you know, like what you said in the beginning, that they're signaling through this very sort of, you know, opaque means various things publicly. They also have to deal with Europe, which is, you know, our long-term alliance with NATO and also just our moral alliance with Europe. And the, you know, the idea that they're having to wrangle an awful lot of different interests in trying to deal with this thing. So there's a lot of moving parts here. And to me, what it seems obvious, and, you know, again, take with a grain of salt my opinion on this, but they're counting on the regime, the Putin regime, falling apart. I mean, I think that is, you know, and that's the most, you know, it's very dangerous as well, because look, you know, who replaces him? I mean, don't know. I mean, is there, you know, some great, peaceful, wonderful, modern, liberal democracy awaiting, or something, you know, just as bad or worse? So I don't know. But I mean, to me, that seems like the logical, you know, at least hope that it is, you know, sort of pushing to just keep the pressure on as hard as they can. On the other hand, I mean, there are signs that they are trying to do diplomacy, under the radar diplomacy with various, you know, players in Turkey and, you know, otherwise, that they're kind of trying to work to do that. So, you know, we don't really know what's going on in that regard. It is true that nobody seems to care about this issue. There are some people on the left and on the right who want to end the American involvement in Ukraine. And basically, you know, many people who think that Ukraine should just go ahead and give it up, that it's a pointless exercise and they're going to lose eventually anyway, or at the very best case scenario is they lose half their country. And then, you know, fight some kind of skirmish over the rest of it for, you know, the foreseeable future. And that's the practical way to look at it, that they're just going to lose. But as you point out, you know, the U.S. intelligence, and I think the European intelligence agencies, too, it wasn't just the U.S.
Right.
And by the way, it wasn't really an illogical thought. I mean, the Russians have had a massive military, a huge amount of military expenditures. You assumed over the years that they were, you know, minimally competent. To see that this kind of disastrous military, you know, kind of result is kind of shocking. I mean, obviously, the intelligence agency should have known better. I mean, you'd think they would have known what was going on with the Russian military. But, you know, remember, Sam, and I mean, you know, you guys know history. This overestimation of Russian military capability goes all the way back to the Cold War. I mean,
right.
this people were running for years. Republicans and right wingers ran for years on the idea that we were underestimating Russian military capability, and then it always turned out that they sucked, basically, at least by comparison. But of course, you know, nuclear. That's the real. Who needs a capable military when you have a nuclear arsenal? And they have a monstrous nuclear arsenal. It's not just, you know, it's not one of these situations like North Korea, who may lob off a couple of, you know, nuclear warheads, as horrifying as that may be. Russia has the capability of ending the world if they somehow went nuts and chose to do it. So that's the big threat that they have, which brings us back to the beginning of the conversation.
Right.
And, you know, what the hell do we do when you've got Russia behaving what appears to me to be pretty incoherently? This move that they made, I mean, just on a purely, you know, strategic level, just seems kind of insane, which is why you look at Vladimir Putin and go, you know, What's happening with this guy? Why, you know, I mean, we've heard all the theories. We don't need to go over it on why he did it and the Russian Empire and Peter the Great and all the rest of the stuff. So there's plenty of reasoning there that we can maybe attribute this to. But really, does it make a lot of sense? I mean, you know, what did they underestimate?
Their intelligence services doing. I think Putin was under the same impression that the CIA was and the European that he was going to take over Ukraine in 3 days, and at that point, like, why not? You know, that you get Crimea, you get the Donbass, and you have a client state in Ukraine, and you know, whether it is a function of or some combination of, like, you know, wanting a return to the Russian Empire or some type of glory, or, you know, is some type of buffer zone, I guess, with NATO, whatever it was, he made a grave miscalculation. And I'm really curious, and I haven't checked in with what John Mearsheimer is saying. And I don't necessarily subscribe to a lot of his analysis necessarily, but, you know, if you're going to have this great power theory, it works both ways, right? Like, of course, the United States is going to press their advantage here. You know, it's one thing that they would have started a proxy war. They clearly did not start this war. It's another that they're going to engage in it in the sense that, like, they can win. And it does appear like, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't bet, I wouldn't even bet Saul's college fund at this point, knowing I got, you know, some years to make up on it on Russia, not, basically having to leave the entire country. And give up Crimea or the Donbass. I don't know. I mean, it's quite clear that it's not going the way that Russia thought it was going to go. I mean, that was clear 7 months ago, 8 months ago. So, but I mean, I don't think that Biden wants a nuclear war, and I also don't think you know, I would like it to go away in the same way that I would like to have wings and fly. But there is not, even putting aside the question of, like, saying to Ukraine, we're not going to fund you at all, because.
No, you can make the funding now from here on out conditional on.
You could, but I don't know what the settlement would be that they would, you know, actually negotiate, like. I don't know what that would look like at this point in Ukraine, particularly when, if you're to believe the news reports, and I don't, you know, you're starting to see, like, mass graves, you're starting to see torture and this and that. Like, I think that's a hard sell, that, like, we're going to trust you guys. You know, do your best in those negotiations. Oh, okay. I mean, it's just one of those.
Well, that has certainly upped the ante on this. The torture, the mass graves, this kind of the atrocities. When you start seeing that stuff, you're in a, you know, especially, I mean, look, this is happening in Europe, right? I mean, this is, you know, it's not that long ago in the great historical sweep of things that they had a very major issue with the, you know, torture, atrocities, etc. In World War II. I mean, Europeans, that's a very fresh memory to them. It really is. I mean, these are people, and one of the things that's a big sign of just how seriously the Europeans are viewing this, I mean, setting aside Ukraine itself, but just the whole region there, is the fact that Sweden and Finland joined NATO.
Right.
And they had resisted this for 60, 70 years. I mean, this was not, I was shocked by it, to tell you the truth. And what it said to me was, oh boy, you know, that this is, they are really seriously concerned. They would not have done that. I mean, these aren't, you know, those are sophisticated countries. They are not, they had resisted this through thick and thin, through the entire Cold War. And then suddenly, when this happened, they suddenly went, okay, you know, enough. We need to be part of this alliance because this is a serious threat. And for me, and, you know, looking at Europe and the way Europe looks at this, when you see atrocities happening on the ground that, you know, and I'm assuming that it's true. I mean, that it's been verified by news organizations and various people there. It's not just, you know, stuff that's coming out on the internet. I mean, this is for real. I don't think the Europeans can tolerate this. I don't think that they can just tolerate saying, okay, fine, you know, take what you want. I mean, that their beliefs around this are very strong, and they count on United States. Well, I mean, it would spell the end of the alliance of America's alliances if they were to just sort of step back and say, hey, guys, you're on your own, which is how the Europeans would feel about that. So, like I said, a lot of moving parts and very, very complicated. And I think they're doing a lot of things, you know, in a bunch of different directions to try and control the situation to the best extent they can. And like you say, spending vast sums of money to do it. With, you know, I mean, we're arguing over stuff like, you know, should we expand the child tax credit? Oh, no, we can't afford it.
Right.
At the same time, writing blank checks for a war. But, hey, that's the way it's always been, isn't it? I mean, that's how we roll here.
Yep. All right. Let's turn to U.S. politics. I mean, it is sort of fascinating how, like, you know, we're just pouring this money in, and there is really no national debate whatsoever about it.
And we're in an election. I mean, yeah. Imagine. I mean, that's just...
I mean, and I brought it up, and I immediately started choking, so they're trying to...
Yeah.
They're trying to silence me.
Big tech is trying to silence.
Yeah.
You're being canceled, Emma.
I know. I'm right. A victim.
So let's turn to your piece about Obamacare. And just, I want to just... In general, but I want to start with this clip, because what was it in 2018? Was it the caravan? It the caravan in 2018?
Yeah.
The Republicans always, you know, are looking for something that will be that will nationalize election. Now, the caravan was really important because Donald Trump was in office. And they wanted to prevent the election from being a referendum on Donald Trump. And so they had to bring up something else that was going to motivate their voters. They bring up the caravan, where you literally had people in Minnesota going, like, I'm worried about my summer home at the lake Winnetonka, because the caravan's coming. They're going to take my home away. they didn't sort of like build up to a caravan thing. And it was amazing. The day after the election, the caravan just sort of like melted away, and like all the caravans do on some level. They didn't build up to it in the same way because they thought they were going to be running against Joe Biden, and abortion in particular, I think, derailed that. I think January 6th commission also started to derail it, but the abortion ruling really did. And there is this separation between Joe Biden and these elections, it feels like, on some level. And Biden has actually done a couple of things between the marijuana stuff and the college debt, you know, marginally helping in terms of bringing up. But here is what it seems like the right has been trying to sort of build. It is the 2022 version of the caravan. Brought to us by one of the good liars.
You get a bag like this at Halloween, do not take it. It's fentanyl. It'll kill you.
Drug dealers, a lot of times, they want to sell their drugs.
Well, not if they're coming over here to destroy our country.
And then so the drug dealers have houses that kids will come and knock on the door on, and then they'll give that to them?
I'm thinking that's how it's going to happen, yeah.
So drug dealers would be giving away...
not drug dealers, the illegals that are here.
Yeah.
They just crossed because Biden has our border wide open.
Okay, so the illegals that have houses that then the kids are coming to knock on the illegals' houses, doors, that and they're drug dealers that are giving the children their drugs.
Look at Fox News. All you got to do is watch an episode of Fox News.
Fox News will tell you that the
it's coming across it's our coming borders. Across. It's going into our playground.
And they're going to be giving it away during Halloween.
Yes.
I mean,
are you stupid? You're not getting it. The illegals are buying houses to give away their drugs for free.
That's
to destroy our country. That's the whole point.
I mean, it you know, it's still like immigration is still the sort of the bailiwick, and they need to make it scary. And of course, you know, people have kids, and that you don't want your kids to be getting fentanyl candy at Halloween. I mean, I think that goes without saying. How you get from A to B is a little bit difficult, but there really does seem to be like no, like Donald Trump, the one thing he did is he really sort of like blew up anything other than Trumpism in terms of the Republican, you know, fictions that they run on. We have no, you know, Paul Ryan's pretending that like he's a wonk and really, you know, we got to cut taxes because he's done the numbers. And there doesn't seem to be, they don't seem to be running on anything.
Well, they're running on culture war, I think.
Right.
I mean, that's just what it
right,
is.
Right, right, right. And, and transphobia, I guess, is
right.
Really.
Oh,
yeah.
That's huge. Transphobia is huge. You know, you've got the grooming of the kids in grade schools. You've got, you know, they've got, what do they have? Afternoon drag shows? Is that, the, you know, or whatever, daycare drag shows or something. I mean, you know, I mean, it's all this. And of course, it all, you know, this is a new, you know, sort of gay panic, I think, is one of the big underlying things. We're going to see that grow over the next couple of years because it's their way of sort of trying to, you know, avoid the abortion issue being at the top of the agenda because, you know, they need to kind of push that down so that they can get their people riled up about something else for the moment and not rile up the other side. And they think that probably gay rights is not going to do that. And they're wrong about that because it will. But yeah, I mean, this is what they've been doing. Now, you know, I wrote a piece this week about, I mean, it just occurred to me the other night when I was thinking, you know, that every election since 2010 featured this gigantic backlash against the Affordable Care Act on the right. And of course, you know, it started off, it was huge. I mean, you guys all remember this. They were, you know, storming town halls and spitting on congressmen. And I mean, it was massive death panels. I mean, the hysteria around it was really unparalleled. It was shocking because it was about healthcare. I mean, you know, it's not, this is the, I don't know, the idea that they were able to churn up this much anger and hostility toward a healthcare program still stuns me to this day.
To Mitt and Romney's. It's basically Mitt Romney's healthcare plan. I mean, the Medicaid expansion was very helpful, but nobody, they didn't pay attention to that at all. No. In fact, they got the Supreme Court to basically say, you know, red states don't have to take the Medicaid expansion, but it was basically Mitt Romney's, you know, healthcare. Yeah. We subsidized private insurance in these exchanges, period.
And that had been the modern approach that everybody had been working toward for years. And, you know, I mean, it really hadn't been particularly controversial up until that point. But again, it was going into the 2010 election, the first midterm, the shellacking, as Obama called it. And the result was horrifying. The whole Congress turned over in massive numbers. You know, this was sort of conjured up by the Republicans. It wasn't just the party, although they were intimately involved. There were all these grassroots groups and also these big AstroTurf groups who were involved, the Koch network and all those people. They just pushed this idea, and they do this every election. And Obamacare was one that really lasted. I mean, it had staying power every single election. 2016, it was huge. 2012, it was huge. They were even running on it in 2018. And they voted against it 67. They voted to repeal it 67 times. 67 times over the course of 7 years. They voted against it 67 times, and it was this massive, you know, backlash against this program, and everybody knew that, you know, hey, and the Democrats made this gamble that if they just hung in there for a while, that it would gain popularity, or at least people would get used to having it. It would be very, very difficult to remove it. They came very, very close, you know, to repealing it. I mean, to actually getting it done. If it hadn't been for
John McCain's thumb.
Being, you know, pissed off that Trump, you know, dissed his military service, it would have been gone. I mean, they were ready to repeal it, and they had, you know, their replace, which was something was a poll tested concept. They never had any replacement, obviously. Not, although Trump said, you know, oh, don't worry, it'll be so easy, you know. Yeah, right. But you know, this thing was a huge thing, and then it's just completely gone, completely off the radar. Nobody has said a word about it in this election. Came up a little bit in 2020 because Trump was still kind of pimping the idea that he could, you know, he had a great plan. Remember, every 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks, we got a plan coming, you know, and it never happened. And so, you know, now, though, this election, not a word about it. And it just tells you something. And, you know, like you point out, the caravan, you've always got something. Now it's fentanyl that looks like Skittles or something that they're supposedly giving away on Halloween. And they actually had the RNC, you know, Ronna McDaniel, the head of the RNC, out there talking about the, you know, be careful, parents, that the fentanyl is going to get in their Halloween bags. I mean, that's totally ridiculous stuff. And, you know, it just ends up being, it's like becoming a running joke in a lot of ways. But what it does also say, and this was something that I just thought in my piece about Obamacare, it's so interesting because Obamacare was maybe the most contentious issue after Iraq, I would say, in American politics of the last
20 years.
20 years.
Without a doubt.
It was huge. It was a gigantic issue, and one that was overwhelmed the political system for you know, one cycle after another. But the Democrats, to their credit, and unusually so, they actually hung in there on that one. See, I would have thought in the past, you know, you could have seen Democrats going, well, you know, the people really don't like it. Maybe we need to, you know, pull back a little bit. Maybe we need to do this, that, or the other. Maybe that, you know, but they didn't. They actually got that done, and then they stuck with it. There's a lesson in that, you know, when you have a good power and you use it and you stick with that, with whatever your policies are that you have enacted, instead of running scared, and you defend those policies over time, those, you know, the right's always going to have something, but those policies will become, you know, accepted and people will move on. There's a good lesson there.
The Inflation Reduction Act they passed, whatever, 3 weeks ago, a month ago, whatever it was, 2 weeks ago, I can't even remember. also extended the subsidies that came in during COVID. And so, And they added to the sort of like the patient protection part where your income, it can't represent more than 8.5% of your income. I mean, there are a couple of lessons. The reason why I think it was so elongated as an issue is because they passed it in 2010, but it did not actually kick in until 2014. And so there was 4 years of just
fear-mongering.
Fear-mongering. And, you know, I mean, the idea that there were people out there going like, you will pry my annual caps on reimbursements from my cold dead hands or something, or the idea that you're going to take away the insurance company's right to take away my health insurance because my cancer treatments are too expensive, that you're not doing that to me. That is, you know, I also think not only was it the biggest contentious issue, I think it was the last, except for maybe Trump's tax cuts, but in terms of Republicans, it was the last issue about policy.
Yes.
That
yes,
existed.
Absolutely.
Like what, you know, the American Rescue Act passes. I mean, they're not going to vote for, you know, Build Back Better, but they're not running against any of them. They're not saying like, you know, if the Democrats take power, if they take two more people in the Senate, they're going to get rid of the filibuster and you're going to end up with paid parental leave. Well, you know, that like there's nobody out there making that argument. It is as if like we're just in a completely culture war battlefield now. And I don't know if in our lifetime we've ever been in that before.
I don't feel like we have. I mean, there's always been the culture war. It's existed. I mean, we've been, you know, it's been going on as long as I can remember.
Without a doubt.
But there was this,
it was in service of some like policies, right? Like, you know, Reagan's up there like welfare queen. Well, we're going to cut welfare. We're going to shrink government. But this doesn't seem to be in service of any specific policy.
No, I mean, they wanted to, you know, repeal Medicare. For years. I mean, you know, the most popular program in America. I mean, you know, this was something that and they had these, you know, and again, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, national security. They had a very strong position in national security. The right did. And now I don't even know what they think about anything, honestly, to do with that. They seem to be just kind of just, you know, shrugging their shoulders, and maybe Donald Trump and NATO getting, you know, paying their dues or some nonsense like that. I mean, that seems to be about it. So, you know, it's very interesting observation, because really this is, and in fact, this election here, this specific one that we're looking at, is completely policy free, as far as I can tell. Now, Democrats have plenty to run on, and they have plenty of promises, and they've actually accomplished quite a bit, considering how narrow the margins were. It's been pretty impressive, you know. I mean, it wasn't what we wanted, but it was certainly better than what we might have expected. And so the Democrats are, you know, they can go out there, hey, we did this, we did that, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But really, that none of that has anything to do with what the election is about. The election is about, you know, these other things, about, you know, fentanyl Skittles and of course the important issues of abortion. You know, abortion rights are huge, and now we see gay rights coming to the forefront as well, and that battle is going to be waged, and that seems to be where we're at. And I don't know what that ends up meaning in terms of government, because I guess for the next 2 years, if the Republicans do win the House at least, and maybe the Senate too, it's just pure investigations into Hunter Biden and impeachment of, you know, various officials. And that's, you know, that's what government will be doing. I mean, that'll be it.
I agree. I mean, I think that's, I mean, like, and his name didn't come up, Herschel Walker, but that's why it's going to be very close in Georgia, and all you need to do is like maybe suppress a couple of votes, you know, or convince a couple of people not to vote for him, pull the lever for him. But broadly speaking, like, I think it's just we're just in this era of negative partisanship where it's like
the best example of this is the religious right and what's happened. I wrote about that today for my Salon column, that they are no longer even, you know, pretending to have any kind of moral basis for their political views. They just don't have it. They're not even trying to. If you see what's happening with Herschel Walker and the fact that, you know, they have been, you know, putting forth these draconian abortion bans, Walker's position is no exceptions at all of any kind, if he has a position, which I don't even know, you know, what he has, but that's what he said. And yet we find out that he has paid for an abortion, at least one, for a woman he was involved with. They don't care. The religious right does not care. They are standing behind him. It's fine. We don't, you know, they have become the ultra pragmatists. All we care about is power. We want to gain power, and this is how we do it. We don't care what these people say. We don't care who they are. They would vote for Adolf Hitler if they thought that he would, you know, give them, and well, they would like Adolf Hitler, frankly, in a lot of cases. But, you know, this is the religious right, which used to be, in which the media and the political, world held up as being an avatar of, you know, of America's moral backbone, was the religious right, and that we all had to kowtow on some level. You had people like, you know, Amy Sullivan and Melinda Henenbreger, right, and all these people, you know, back in the early 2000s who were going on and on about how we had to do outreach to the religious right and had to moderate our views on abortion and gay rights and all these things, because these people were the moral arbiters basically, of America. And it, you know, and we all knew, I mean, we all knew that that was complete nonsense, that these people were just basically hardcore political operatives in many cases. But nonetheless, that was held up. And now they're not even trying to hide it. Yeah, Dana Lash is out there saying, you know, I don't care. I'd vote for anybody. Yeah.
I don't think that's irrational on their part. I mean, it worked with Donald Trump. Donald Trump undoubtedly paid for abortions, and he also made it possible for the religious right to impose their theocratic views on the rest of the country.
He's an imperfect vessel for what we need.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think they care about the individual. I mean, I don't think it's irrational. I certainly, like, you know, I was just saying here, like, you know, if I had to vote for Menendez over a Republican, I would, because Menendez is going to be part of that. So, I mean, it makes sense in that regard.
But that was not what these people said. That wasn't how they held themselves out. They were saying that we're about character matters. You remember this was their whole thing.
Yes. So, you know, I forgot. What are we going to tell the kids? What are we going to tell the kids about Bill Clinton? Yes. Mm-hmm. Heather, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Folks can check out your most recent pieces at salon.com and, of course, at Hullabaloo.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It was great.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Greg Mitchell, author, documentary filmmaker. His newest film, The First Attack Ads, Hollywood versus Upton Sinclair. It's out on PBS, streaming now. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report joining us and welcoming back to the program, or MNIR, I should say, Greg Mitchell, author, documentary filmmaker. His newest film is The First Attack Ads, Hollywood versus Upton Sinclair. It's out on PBS, streaming now, based on a book that you wrote about this very thing. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
All right. For folks who don't know much about Upton Sinclair, tell us who he was that he would generate this amount of concern, and essentially so much so that it developed the first attack ads.
Okay, thank you. Well, Upton Sinclair, some of us, even going back to our high school days, learned was one of the original muckrakers in the early part of the previous century. And he was most famous for a book about the Chicago stockyards and the horrible conditions of our food that most people ate, called The Jungle, which surprisingly, you may find out, actually was a novel, not a nonfiction book, but very famous for The Jungle. And then for a lot of people, he kind of disappears into consciousness, but he was one of the most famous Americans, certainly the most famous socialist in the country. Known around the world, wrote dozens of other books, some of them very influential, took on Hollywood, took on the press, took on every social issue. He took on big business. He wrote a book called Oil, which became the film not so long ago, Will Be Blood, with Daniel Day-Lewis. Mm. He wrote a book about the Sacco Vanzetti case, and it just had an incredible life and career. And had run for governor of California twice as a socialist and got, relatively few votes. But in 1934, in the depths of the Depression, he took a cue from FDR. You know, the FDR had just been elected. FDR seemed to be trying to do a lot of great things. And he felt, well, if I run for governor this time as a Democrat, maybe I'll do better. And, lo and behold, he attracted one of the greatest mass movements in U.S. history called End Poverty in California. And in my book, you mentioned the book is called The Campaign of the Century, came out quite some time ago, but is now considered a classic, if I may say. there's more about that than there is in my film, but this movement was just, it's one of the great left-wing movements of all time. It attracted millions of people, hundreds of epic chapters around the state. They had a weekly newspaper that had like a million subscribers. And lo and behold, he swept the Democratic primary in a landslide and appeared to be headed for victory in November. And this was, of course, a very scary thing for the vested interests. And both Republicans and conservative Democrats, of which there were many. And so in the course of a couple months in the fall of 1934, they went out and invented the modern political campaign as we know it today, not just with attack ads, but with the first use of outside people from outside the political parties. So they hired the very first political consultants in the country. They outsourced advertising to Madison Avenue. They did national fundraising for a state race, which was sort of unheard of. So basically, they invented the modern spin doctor, political consultant, attack ad campaign that we see today.
What? How much of? And I know this is more, about the book. And I think one of the things I think hopefully, personally, I hope happens is people watch the documentary, and it's a gateway into understanding a little bit more, and maybe they go and read your book about Sinclair's run. But how much of the fact? Well, I have two questions about that run. One, how much? I mean, he certainly did better running as a Democrat, right? Because it sort of like put some type of like comfortable veneer on his proposals that he was offering,
right?
And so I think that's instructive in some way. How much was the concern about Sinclair a function of these forces feeling like they were caught surprised by FDR?
Yeah. Well, you know, FDR had been elected 2 years earlier. And, you know, with the New Deal, and some of his proposals had already gone into effect, but most of them hadn't yet. The New Deal was, had a lot of struggles. And so, for example, Sinclair was way ahead of FDR in basically proposing what's now Social Security. He was ahead in these massive, massive jobs programs. This is basic policy was, we have all these people, we have all these resources and land. Let's put everyone to work. And, then we'll have all these products and food and so forth. And we can feed everybody and make money selling the products. And of course, FDR then got through the Works Progress Administration and the second half of the New Deal. And so, of course, the big business, particularly in California, which included Hollywood, was terrified by this because it was socialistic, even though he was running as a Democrat. He certainly called for higher taxes. So it was it was very scary for them. And so they just unleashed the full fury and the full resources that they had.
Who were, in Hollywood, it was a different place than it is today in some respects, right? I mean, it was, obviously, but it was just a couple of guys essentially back then, who controlled just about everything. Who was the greatest, Sinclair, hater, I guess.
Well, there were actually about six major studios there, and almost all of them were run by right-wing moguls. I know this surprises people today because they think the sort of the lefty Hollywood goes back forever. When in actuality, this campaign was so outrageous and so offended the liberal screenwriters and the liberal actors that they then moved Hollywood to the left. We had the the surge in the Screenwriters Guild and the Screen Actors Guild. And so this campaign actually tilted Hollywood in the direction you now see it. But back then, it was run by basically right-wing moguls. And the leader was Louis B. Mayer, who was the founder of MGM, who actually had been head of the Republican Party in California very recently. And so he was, if you say who's the most, the biggest hater, would have been him. But the my film shows that the person who really produced the first attack ads was the revered and always always give out the award at the Oscars, Irving Thalberg, the boy wonder, super clean, revered by all. And you know, if this starts to sound familiar to anyone out there, it's because this formed a important subplot in the recent movie Mank, which the David Fincher movie, in which Upton Sinclair and Irving Thalberg are characters. And, you know, you see a little bit that's in my film is called The True Story of What Happened. But Mank is the kind of the Hollywood version, but it gets some things right. And so a lot of people were kind of prepped for my film, I suppose, by the wide exposure for Mank a couple of years ago.
What and we should say, if folks are interested in the book, you can go back to April 2014, I think it was, when we had you on to talk about the book that was sort of at least part of this film is based on that, in that book. Or I should say this film is based on part of that book.
Right.
What's also interesting is there has not been I suppose there have been advances in terms of like the technology that you use and sort of like the targeting, but in terms of like the tropes and the memes, as it were, I don't think they were called memes then. that has been sort of like, that has been quite durable. Like what things were developed with Sinclair that you see, you know, that we'll see, I don't know, this time around, or particularly in the presidential campaigns, I guess, where it's more focused on a single person.
Right. Well, there was fundraising, which led to slush funds with secretive groups or shadowy groups who were able to produce advertising and leaflets and pamphlets and direct mail. You know, there really, again, this is a campaign, again, was... so we sort of saw the invention, or at least the explosion of direct mail. What the hell? Direct mail with send things right to people's mailbox? You know, what a concept. So you basically had, you know, kind of secret funding of shadowy groups that provided millions of leaflets in direct mail. And certainly all the dirty tricks that we've seen in terms of not just the attack ads, but you know, the really personal attacks, crazy, wild schemes to embarrass Sinclair, very personally aimed at him, not so much at his followers. But he was, you know, branded a communist. He was actually anti-communist, but he was a socialist, so that was, you know, close enough. And they did something that's, I mean, it's almost humorous, but the LA Times every day ran on its front page a little box which purportedly quoted Sinclair. So he would say the most outrageous things, you know, how we should, you know, nationalize children was one of them. But every possible extreme view, and most of the quotes actually were from characters in Sinclair's novels. They were not actually things that Sinclair said, but they were like maybe bad guys in Sinclair's novels. And why that kind of echoes today is the sense today that Republicans particularly can say anything. You know, they can charge anything, they can allege anything, and there's no – people accept it. There are a lot of people accept it. Nothing's out of the – you know, nothing's off the boards. And they just sail through, and it's almost like not caring. And it was very much in this race the fact of the Sinclair opponents are saying, yeah, we know this is crazy. We know this – never passes the fact checking, but we're going to say it because we're going to benefit, because we're down to the last month or two of the campaign, and you know, we can get away with it.
that, like, that awareness seems to be, I mean, maybe it's been mitigated a little bit in terms of the internet. I mean, and I should tell people that, like, my first exposure to you was back when you were writing for Editor and Publisher. Right. And writing that, and your outlet was one of the few in the run-up to the Iraq War that was sort of like both reporting and gathering the reporting that showed we were being lied into war. Yeah, I mean, McClatchy was a very good, you know, I remember, stood out. But I remember distinctly, like, yours being a voice on the sort of the nascent web, reporting that. And on some level, we, over the course of like the 20 years since then, we went through this period where people were fact checking and there was pushback. And now we're almost sort of like passed through that into an area where the signal to noise ratio changed again, and not for the better in terms of like figuring out the truth. That concept of like, we can lie, and if we do it at the right time, we're not going to be held to it's not going to backfire, because people get hit with one, you know, it's like, put up a tweet completely wrong. Well, I did another tweet, you know, 6 hours later that corrected it, and
I don't care, but
they can put that correction up because they know only 1/8 of the people who read the original tweet or less are going to see the correction, and it works, and you've covered yourself on some level. They realize they didn't even have to cover themselves in that way, but that dynamic, like, that was a lesson that we didn't want people to learn, and they learned it.
Yeah. Well, in the Sinclair campaign, the three movie shorts that were produced by Thalberg all came out in the last 10 days of the campaign. And, you know, they caused riots, and, you know, the Sinclair supporters at first laughed about them because they were so outrageous. But, you know, they were in every movie theater in California when everyone went to the movies, you know, nothing like today. And it was like watching TV, you know, which movie are we going to watch tonight? Mm. So it had tremendous exposure, and it came at the end of the campaign. And the press also, the New York Times, far away in New York, raised some questions about the legitimacy of the newsreels. But the California press certainly didn't. And so they were just tremendously effective, partly due to the timing and partly due to people back then, particularly, really trusted what they saw on the screen. You know, that's why these movie shorts in 1934 were so significant, was because until then, people did not, you know, politicians and party officials did not use the screen for this kind of propaganda. So when I say this was the first attack ads, of course, I mean the first attack ads on the screen. We've had dirty politics going back to, you know, Jefferson and Washington. But it really hadn't occurred to them to really put propaganda on the screen in support of a candidate. And so this was a real eye-opener because, you know, I don't – spoiler alert, it was successful and Sinclair lost. But the Epic campaign itself was tremendously influential, not only on FDR, but in California. California started electing progressives, and in fact, they elected their first Democratic governor ever 4 years later. So, you know, I could cite 20 ways this campaign was significant, both, you know, pro and con. But the fact is that the attack ads did work. And I should say, the film, you know, it's airing on PBS stations around the country all month. You know, it was in the two leading LA stations this week. It was on WNET channel 13 in New York, the largest station, last night, and it's on stations around the country. But it's not a Ken Burns kind of rollout where you could say next Monday,
right,
on every PBS station at 9 o'clock. So you do have to check your listings. But what I want to emphasize is that, for some reason, I'm not sure why they do it this way, but it's already available free online and streaming. Just go to pbs.org and put in the first attack ads, and you'll be able to watch it 26 minutes anytime you want for at least this month. It's also on all the PBS apps, including Apple TV. So it's very easy to find and very easy to watch. You don't have to watch it on a PBS station. I know that's kind of the nicest way to watch, I suppose. But so anyway, so this film is available to all. This is not something that's obscure, and it's all via PBS.
Excellent. Well,
and you can watch movie shorts. I have long excerpts from the three movie shorts. You can actually see them with you know, with some analysis. You'll laugh, you'll cry, but you can watch them.
Greg Mitchell, the film is The First Attack Ads, Hollywood versus Upton Sinclair. Like you say, go to pbs.org, just search for that. You can watch that or check your local listings. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
And I'll just mention the book title again is The Campaign of the Century.
Great. Thanks, Greg.
Thank
Great
you.
To see you again.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. Nailed it.
Today. Nice. Yes.
134.
Whoa.
Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member. Join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only allow this show to survive and thrive, but you also get the free half, free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. Mm. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Emma.
Yes.
Big week this week. Roger Maris's record breaking.
Right.
Did you even talk about that?
No.
No?
That's more North Dakota news.
I guess we could have talked about it yesterday, but I was tired.
I have opinions on it. It's not really the record.
Yeah, they're being a bit, you know, it's a bit over the top. We get it. It's just because it's...
the non-steroidal record.
All right.
Allegedly.
Anyway, I'm not big into baseball. So, but we did have a baseball guest on Monday who talked about what was Greg Kaplan spoke about his predictions for the Major League Baseball playoffs. But on ESVNOT, we gave our picks for the weekend. That was yesterday, and we encourage people in the comment section to pick what is going to happen to either Bradley or myself when we win or lose this season-long competition between the two of us against the spread. Now, if you want to go to the video, you can comment and let us know what you think would be a good idea. There's a lot of jersey suggestions. I saw a suggestion that one of us has to watch a full TV show of the other's choosing. There's the classic, you got to take the SAT. But we'll see. I mean,
Tim Pool concert.
Yeah, right now Bradley's one game behind me, so we're like, this is a good time when it's this close for us to make these choices. So subscribe to ESVN show and listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, rate us 5 stars, all that good stuff.
I might be interested in funding the attendance of a Tim Pool concert or something like that. Sending one of you guys there. I mean, it would involve a little bit of reportage and travel. But
yeah.
Matt. What's happening in the Matt Leckian universe?
Is Tim Pool concert, is that real? Where did that come from?
I'm just saying, like, if there is one, it could
something like that.
Or send you to
Jordan Peterson lecture.
Stephen Crowder stand-up routine.
That would be fun.
Oh, my God.
Red Bank, New Jersey.
But this weekend, patreon.com/leftreckoning, Gene Bajelan. We're talking about the Kurdish angle of the Iran protest why, you know, people shouldn't rush to call everything a color revolution and CIA inspired. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that conversation.
You saying that the Iranian protests are not simply a function of the CIA?
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. Not simply a function of the CIA.
Shocking.
Weird. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Matt. What is up, everyone? Fun hack. Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun hack.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun hack.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Ooh, libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sundial guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.